From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll look at the budget deficit MCTS is facing and what's to come for the bus system. Then, learn about the decline of monarch butterflies and what can be done about it.
Over the last decade, the monarch population average has been about a quarter of what it used to be when we first started measuring them.
Plus, a new Bubbler Talk explores the origins of one of Milwaukee's most notable murals.
They wanted to do a mural on the Dye Building, and they wanted to pay tribute to the history of the building, and more specifically, pay tribute to working women, past and present.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. Milwaukee County's transit system keeps the buses running across the city and county, but that service, which thousands depend on, is facing some major challenges. WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez talked with Urban Milwaukee reporter Graham Kilmer about the issues facing the Drivers Union and MCTS. But first, we'll hear from Bruce Freeman, president of the Amalgamated Transit Union, which represents MCTS bus drivers and mechanics.
I drove for approximately 20 years. Driving the bus, especially in the early days, was exciting. It was a position that people desired. It was a waiting list to get in for driving the buses. And then when I got in, I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. Up until, you know, a few years ago when we start getting a different element of ridership, the culture is a little different. So things have started to change a little bit.
How have things changed over the time since when you started to now?
Well, we started noticing differences right around COVID. The bus company offered free rides for a while. And when it came back to the time where they wanted people to start paying fare, people kind of got used to not paying fare. So it kind of ballooned into a fare evasion problem. Before that, people got on the bus. They were respectful of the bus drivers. You know, we had fare evasions then, but it wasn't quite as rampant as it is now. And now with that being in place with the fare evasions and some of the policies that go along with that from the company, it kind of puts a little extra stress on the drivers because they're dealing with people who are not paying bus fare on top of being unruly on the bus with that.
Yeah, Graham Kilmer, County Government Reporter, Urban Milwaukee.
Graham, thank you for jumping into the studio with me because this is an ongoing story, but it really feels like MCTS is going through it. Can you break down what's happening with the drivers and MCTS right now?
Yeah, they're facing multiple crises, but they're all kind of wrapped up together. The big overarching one is the funding. MCTS has a longstanding structural deficit. And to a certain extent, the operating deficit that they're seeing right now in 2025 is that longstanding deficit finally showing its face after so many years being covered up by federal funds. So what happened was that in June, MCTS announced in the press that they were facing a $10.9 million budget deficit. And all the elected officials from the county executive to the county board of supervisors all found out as they were, you know, scrolling, watching TV that day, oh, MCTS has a budget deficit.
So this is not how business is usually conducted.
No, typically you would inform the officials responsible for the budget that you are not meeting the budget or that you're going to need more funding or that you're, you know, making some changes. And then on top of that, the transit system is in the middle of contract negotiations for a new 3-year contract with the transit union. And those have been ongoing for months, but in May, I had a union official reach out to me and essentially tell me, in his words, he felt like negotiations were breaking down. I reached out to MCTS. That's not how they felt. Fast forward a couple months now, the union has recently provided its leaders with strike authority, which essentially means that as negotiations progress, the union can call a strike, call a work stoppage at just about any time. And that means the buses aren't rolling.
Taking it from the drivers, what are they seeing? Why did they make this move to authorize a strike?
Well, they just felt like MCTS was not negotiating in good faith. According to Vice President Michael Brown, they struggled to get MCTS to negotiate on major financial items. They were mostly, you know, picking around the edges at small policy matters. And then the day that they were due to start negotiating major financial items in the contract, an MCTS official walks into the meeting and hands the union negotiators a piece of paper, and it's the press release announcing the budget deficit printed out. The union did not feel that was a professional way to inform them of the budget deficit, and they also felt like the system was using this deficit as leverage in the negotiations. I don't know whether that's true or not, but that's how it felt for them, and that's what they have communicated to me. And it was after that that they made the decision to go to a strike vote.
Where do the drivers union and MCTS go from here?
Well, they're on a contract extension, and what that means is that the existing contract, which has already been expired for months, they keep giving it 30-day extensions, so the operators, they're operating under the old contract, and that extension goes until the end of the month. The union wants a new contract. They don't want to call a strike. All my conversations with them have indicated that they don't take striking lightly. It's important to them that they keep the buses rolling. It also means their members aren't getting paid if they call a strike. So the fact that they've called a strike vote and done strike authority for the past three contract negotiations since they went on strike in 2015, what this highlights is a very serious breakdown in trust between the rank and file workers of MCTS, the operators, the bus mechanics, and the people managing the system in the administration.
What complicates all of this, obviously, is this budget deficit. How do we get here, and what does this mean for the county and for these negotiations?
How did we get here? That's a great question, and one that I feel like myself personally, and I think others, don't feel like has been answered. The system has talked about the items contributing to the deficit. So they point to excessive overtime. They point to a contract for their paratransit provider that is way over budget. They point to the prices of commodities, bus parts, etc. Those all kind of explain the numbers, the math that add up to the budget deficit. But what we haven't heard yet is how they managed to get 6 months into the year and not catch it, or why they didn't report it earlier. Those are questions that still have not been answered.
I think what is novel about this time is the exhausting of those ARPA funds, and that funding that was kind of floating, that overtime and the work and also the county and all of the projects they wanted to do. What happens next? How does the county fill this gap? I know we're kind of speculating, as this is the deficit is pretty new news, but has there been any word on how the county would address that?
Well, we know the state isn't going to help out because they just passed the biennial budget and the mass transit aides were held flat. It's the same that they're going to always get from the state. So what the transit system is looking at, just from a purely dollars and cents point of view, is they're looking at major cuts, or the county is going to have to try and scrape together some cash, tax levy, to backfill that deficit. It's worth pointing out that MCTS is already talking about doing cuts in the fall, service cuts, to try to tamp down this existing operating deficit. They're going to cut efficiency, which is essentially the rate at which buses operate along a route. So where a route has so many buses coming during a 30-minute period today, there will be fewer buses during that 30-minute period on that same route once the cuts go through.
Okay, so if I'm hearing you right, those busy lines are seeing more buses, and the slower lines, the less used lines, maybe seeing less buses?
So, yeah, essentially what it was a few years ago, they redesigned the system. It was called MCTS Next. And what they were doing is they were boosting up bus frequency along a number of, you know, major transit corridors. Essentially, they're targeting the cuts at the thing that the system has recently been redesigned to provide. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of a very in-the-weeds way of saying that the system faces a number of very serious questions about its operations and its service, and we don't really have the answers to a lot of those questions yet. I know county policymakers certainly have not announced how they're going, you know, what they're going to do with the transit system, how they're going to fund it, where those funds will come from.
So you brought up the very serious questions, and the answers don't exist yet, but when could they? When could folks find out what happens to MCTS and the union and the budget?
So we'll probably find out where contract negotiations land at some point in the next month, I would assume. The budget will probably be in the fall. Certainly, County Executive David Crowley will provide an indication of where his administration is at in terms of transit when he releases his budget proposal in late September, early October. But yeah, the budget process is really where the rubber is going to meet the road here, because MCTS wasn't supposed to, for lack of better phrasing, run out of money until 2028. As you noted, they had all this federal stimulus funding that they've been slowly spending down, backfilling their budget gap with for years. And just last year, they, in their words, shelved planning for a new bus rapid transit line because they had put all this federal stimulus money into the planning process. And they figured out that if they stopped planning that new service and they took that money out, they could just kind of pump it back into the budget and keep operations where they're at for a few more years, until 2028. Well, here we are in 2025, and we're posting a deficit. I imagine 2026 is going to be a very difficult budget for the transit system.
The Milwaukee County Transit System, bus operators, mechanics, they're very dedicated force. We would always like to, you know, fight and be competitive as far as wages go. But on the other hand, the service to the public is our main focus. When you start talking about cuts to service and cuts to workforce and all of that kind of stuff, it kind of weighs on the public. We would like to just make sure that the public knows that this is just not a fight for money. We're fighting for security. We're fighting for safe rides on the bus. We're fighting for the company to come up with a reasonable antidote for this fare evasion problem that we got here.
That was Graham Kilmer, urban Milwaukee reporter who covers the county. He spoke with WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez. You also heard from Bruce Freeman, president of the Amalgamated Transit Union. The Milwaukee County Transit System released a statement that reads in part, quote, "We support our bus operators, mechanics, and cleaners and the great work they do every day. While we respect the right of our employees to exercise their right to strike, we also know that thousands of people rely on MCTS to get to work, school, and other appointments. As such, we will continue to engage in negotiations with the union to reach a contract that is fair." End quote. You can read the full statement at WUWM.com. Milwaukee County Transit is a financial contributor to WUWM. Have you lost something precious, or are you curious if there might be something valuable hidden on your property? Well, then you'll want to stick around for our conversation with a metal detectorist in about 20 minutes. But first, we'll tell you about the rebounding population of monarch butterflies and what can be done to support them in your own backyard. Keep listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Monarch butterfly populations have nearly doubled this year. Although it's certainly welcome news, scientists say it's still the fifth lowest number of monarchs on record. Karen Oberhauser is the co-founder and co-director of the Monarch Larva Monitoring Project. She says habitat loss, climate change, and the use of pesticides are to blame for the population decline. Lake Effects expert Nunez is joined by Oberhauser to learn how monarchs are doing in Wisconsin this summer and ways people can help conserve them.
The Monarch Larva Monitoring Project is a community science project based at the UW-Madison Arboretum. Can you tell me more about the work that it does?
Sure. We have volunteers all over the monarch's breeding range, which includes parts of Canada, most of the United States, and northern Mexico. And volunteers go out once a week and look at a local milkweed patch. It can be in their yard or a nature center or a pristine prairie somewhere. And they look at as many milkweed plants as they have time for. And they keep track of how many monarch eggs and caterpillars they see on these plants. So with their data, we can see how the population is doing throughout the course of the breeding season. And we can also measure things like survival. So we can look at the absolute numbers of eggs that are being laid, which is a measure of the size of the adult population. But we can look at survival through the egg and larval period of the life cycle. So we really get good real-time data of how the population is doing in the summer. And some of our volunteers collect some of the larvae that they find, and they bring them into their homes and rear them. And from that, we can measure parasitism rates and survival in more detail than we can just by recording what the volunteers are seeing outside. But most of our volunteers only do looking at the plants and counting the eggs and caterpillars.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And what are some of the factors that have hurt monarch populations over the years and the threats that they continue to face?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of different things that are threatening monarchs, and they're the same things that are threatening other butterflies, other insects, other organisms in general. The biggest one is probably habitat loss. The vast majority of the central part of the United States was prairie, and that was perfect monarch habitat. So there was a lot of habitat available to them. And then with the encroachment of settlers and people coming and taking all that prime prairie land and turning it into farmland, we lost a lot of habitat. And now that's continuing with urban sprawl. So habitat loss is a really big driving factor. But monarchs and other insects are also really tightly tied to weather. And we know that weather conditions are changing with climate change. And what we're finding is that the conditions that are currently more prevalent and that are predicted to become even more prevalent, hot, dry conditions, followed by sometimes really intense periods of rain instead of kind of leveled out over the course of a summer, those are hard for monarchs. So weather extremes. And probably the other biggest thing is pesticide use. For instance, when there's insect control in a yard, maybe to control mosquitoes, that is a general insecticide that's being sprayed. So that will kill all insects, including monarchs and butterflies and beneficial insects, the ones that might be eating the mosquitoes. So there's residential and then broad-scale pesticide use for agriculture. So those are probably the three biggest drivers: climate change, habitat loss, and pesticide use, specifically insecticide use.
Yeah, and I can see how these factors all kind of work together too. And, you know, people are familiar with monarch butterflies as an insect that's absolutely stunning, but why are they ecologically important?
Yeah, that's a really great question, Excarit. There are roles that monarchs play in the ecosystem. They are pollinators. They're herbivores that the larvae provide food for other animals further up the food chain. But monarchs are not specialist pollinators like bees are. Bees are really efficient pollinators. And when a bee goes out to forage for the day, it often goes to one kind of plant. It has specialized hairs on its body for carrying pollen. And monarch pollination is a little more haphazard than that. So when we talk about why monarchs should be conserved, it's a little more nuanced. So for one thing, we are responsible for the decline of monarchs. So some people would say that we have an ethical reason, so it's up to us to fix it. Another reason is that people really care about monarchs and they build connections between humans and the natural world. So a lot of people only recognize monarchs. They don't recognize any other insect. The connections that people build with monarchs are good for conservation in general. So monarchs are kind of this bridge that can benefit the natural world.
Absolutely. And I want to switch over to talk about this report that came out from the World Wildlife Foundation. And in this report, it says that this year's monarch butterfly population has nearly doubled compared to last year. So I was wondering if you could explain these findings and what caused the shift.
That's a great question. And if people can imagine in their head kind of an EKG, an erratic EKG, where the numbers are going up and down. But if we imagine the monarch population size, it's ups and downs, but an overall downward trend, kind of like a slowing down heartbeat. So we can explain the ups and downs by weather conditions, but the long downward trend is probably driven by the factors that we talked about, a kind of long-term climate change, which is different than year-to-year variation. Also loss of habitat and probably pesticide use as well. So over the last decade, the monarch population average has been about a quarter of what it used to be when we first started measuring them. Last year, before we got this uptick, was the second lowest on record over more than 30 years of record keeping. So we did almost double from last year, but that doubling was still the fifth lowest on record. So it's a lot easier for the population to tick up when it was so low the previous year. What we think probably happened is that the fall migration was better. The numbers in the upper Midwest where we are were pretty similar between the summer of 2023 and the summer of 2024. But monarchs had probably a more successful fall migration. The weather conditions as they were migrating to Mexico were better. So the population size went up in Mexico. And I should note here that that report that you mentioned that came out from the World Wildlife Fund Mexico, monarchs are measured in Mexico because that's when the whole population or almost all of the population is together in one place. But the way that we measure monarchs is not in numbers of monarchs, it's in area. People actually go out and measure the area that's covered with trees that have monarchs in them. So that's what went up. It's the area of trees covered with monarchs.
That's so interesting. I'm like imagining football-sized fields of monarchs right now.
Yeah, and it is about the size of two football fields is where all those monarchs were found. So it's kind of an incredibly small area when you think of it. But it's not just those two contiguous football fields. It's 12 areas that are spread out, sometimes separated by several kilometers. So it's a couple trees here and a couple trees there and a couple trees on another mountaintop. So they're looking in Mexico for very specific conditions. They're fairly high on the mountains. These are mountains that are, they're called the Transvolcanic Mountains that go east and west across Mexico. And monarchs are going to the peaks of those mountains, the tops of the mountains, where conditions are just right for their winter survival.
And something that I've recently seen a few nature centers in the Milwaukee area report that community science volunteers have noticed an increase in monarch sightings. But I'm curious, what have you been seeing in Wisconsin so far this year?
Well, it's a little early to see. It felt like I was hearing from a lot of people, and what I was seeing is the first generation did not seem very big. We didn't see a lot in terms of either butterflies or their eggs and caterpillars in the first generation. So numbers were a little low, not that much lower than the last couple of years, and we don't have all the data in yet, but they were either the same or slightly lower than they had been the last couple of years. But right now, we're starting to get an uptick again. So if people right now are feeling like they're seeing more monarchs, it's because they're starting to see that new generation. So I would predict that they'll see more and more and more through kind of the third week in July. The population will be increasing. And then the numbers will start going back down as those adults die off and before we get the migratory generation. So we are on an increase right now. So if people are seeing that, that's great. That means they're out in the natural world and making observations. So that's a good sign that they're seeing more.
Absolutely. And that leads me to my next question. Like, what does an ideal habitat for monarchs look like?
Sure. I love that question because it can look like a lot of different things. It needs the basics. It needs flowers for the adults to provide nectar for the adults because the adults have a relatively long life for an insect. They'll live 4 to 6 weeks. So they need to eat flowers. It needs milkweed because that's all that the caterpillars can eat. So the female butterflies, female monarchs lay their eggs on milkweed plants. So nectar plants and milkweed. And the milkweed can be many, there are many different species. We have 12 species of milkweed that are native in Wisconsin. So it doesn't have to just be common milkweed. Then the other things are no pesticides. So there can't be any insecticide use in the habitat. So a great monarch habitat could look like a container garden. It can look like a small backyard garden, maybe a 10 foot by 10 foot garden, as long as it has those components. Or it can be a 40 acre prairie. Or it can be a roadside or the right of way on a railroad track. So it can be anything in between there. And as long as it has those basic conditions of plant availability for the adults and caterpillars, and no pesticide use, it can be a great monarch habitat. So people can help monarchs with a relatively small amount of space. Monarchs are just fine in your city yard or even your container garden.
Absolutely, yeah. And some people might think that raising monarchs at home might be helpful, but is that true or what do you think?
Yeah. So we do have a lot of people that feel like, okay, the population is going down. I know that there's a lot of mortality, and there is. Only about 5% of the eggs that are laid survive to adulthood. So they think, well, we should just raise monarchs to help them. Raising monarchs can be good for several reasons. It can teach us more if people report their data to the Monarch Larva Monitoring Project. It's very easy. If you bring in a monarch, you can report what happens to it, and we learn about monarchs. And that helps us preserve them. Raising a monarch connects people to monarchs, making them more concerned about monarchs and other insects in the natural world. But monarch scientists, including me, do not recommend that people raise monarchs if their goal is to help the population. And there are many reasons for that, but there are some risks. First of all, raising them inside, or even if you have them on a porch, can affect their exposure to natural light conditions. And we know that at the end of the summer, those monarchs that are going to migrate, if they aren't exposed to exactly the right conditions, they have less success in migrating. Raising monarchs can also, if they're not raised carefully, can result in disease. So even if the monarchs survive, they might have transmitted disease from one to the other. And the other problem with thinking we can help monarchs by rearing a lot is we're just rearing them into a world that doesn't have enough habitat for them and that might have pesticides. So in order to solve the problem of the decline in monarch numbers, what we really need to do is address the things that cause the problem. And it wasn't survival, kind of natural predators that caused the problem. It was loss of habitat and pesticides and climate. So we're just raising these monarchs and releasing them back into a world that's not good for them. So what I recommend, I don't say that people should not rear any monarchs because I raise some monarchs every summer. I report them to the Monarch Larva Monitoring Project. I love raising them. I share them with my grandchildren and my neighbors. So I don't want to sound like I'm saying never rear monarchs, but the reason for rearing them should not be to help the population because it doesn't.
Well, thank you, Karen, so much for speaking with me today. I really appreciated learning more about our monarch butterflies and how to care for them.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to talk with you.
Karen Oberhauser is the co-founder and co-director of the Monarch Larva Monitoring Project. She's also the former director of UW-Madison's Arboretum. She spoke with Lake Effect's Excrete Nunez. In about 15 minutes, we'll tell you about a mural in Milwaukee's Third Ward that has turned some heads. But first, we'll meet a local metal detectorist who offers to search local properties for hidden treasure. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Have you ever wondered what might be hidden underground? Well, a metal detectorist can help with that. Bruce Retkowski is a metal detectorist who travels the state finding homeowners who want their old property searched for historical objects. Lake Effect's Excrete Nunez spoke with Retkowski about his love for metal detecting and what makes Milwaukee a special place to search.
I'm curious, what got you interested in metal detecting and what keeps you going?
My brother-in-law, Tom, and his wife have a property up around Mauston area, and there's a lake up there called Castle Rock Lake that has an island in it. And they take their boat out there, and around that island, there is a lot of sand. So people take and they park their boats, and they wade through the water, and they have parties, and they lose their stuff. And he was a detectorist at the time, and he said, come on, we're going to try this. So, you know, he showed me how to do things and found some interesting items around that island because that island used to be a farmland. They created that lake by damming the Wisconsin River. One of the things that he found, which had nothing to do with metal, in his scoop one time, he brought up a bison tooth. Bison haven't been in Wisconsin for many, many years, and he got that verified by a UWM scientist.
And so how long have you been doing this for? Like, what year was that when you started?
It's about 10 years. Started out slow, and my wife said, I think I'm going to get you a metal detector for your birthday. And so I got a beginner metal detector, and it's been forward since then.
What a gift.
Yes, I was very happy to receive that.
And so I'm curious, you've been doing this for 10 years now. Is there a certain item that really sparked your interest in metal detecting and wonder what else is underground?
Oh my gosh, there's so many items. The big item that people always want to find is gold. I found three gold items. I found two gold rings and a gold necklace that has a silver cross on it. My friend in the Milwaukee area found a $5 gold piece, which dates back to the mid-1800s, I believe. And that's the prize. That's, you know, you always want to find the gold, the hidden treasure. Another friend went over to England and he found a gold coin that dates back to, I believe, the 1500s. So there's always the gold to find, but most of the stuff you pull out is trash, junk, you know, pop tops, cans, nails, and things like that. But you're always looking for that silver coin or the, you know, the gold ring or the silver ring. Or if you're on an older property, just something to relate to that property that you can give to that owner and say, well, this looks like a handle from your door or something like that.
And so what do you, okay, say you find a gold ring. What do you, like, you're not really in it for the money, are you? Or are you more in for the history of it?
I'm definitely not in for the money. The story I like to tell is that somebody emailed me about losing her mom's gold wedding band. Her mom had passed away when she was 7, and her dad gave her the mom's wedding band. And she said, I was at a family reunion, you know, I lost it, we tried to find it, you know, I'm out here in California, I was at a family reunion in West Bend, could you try to find it? And I told her, well, I've never found anything intentionally, but I will, you know, I'll recruit a couple guys, you know, do you have any idea where in the yard it might have been lost? She sent me an overhead picture, and she drew where most of the people were gathering. We got there, and I had two guys with me, and my friend found it in 20 minutes. Wow. So she got her mom's wedding band back, and she was overjoyed. You know, she said, what can I give you guys? What can I give you guys? We told her, you know, we don't want anything. Your happiness that the ring has been found and returned to you is more than enough for us.
So these items have a lot of sentimental value as well as historical value.
Yes. If we find something on a property that, like you said, is sentimental, we always show it to the property owner and we say, you know, you can decide if you want to keep it or not. If it doesn't belong to them, they can still keep it, or they can, you know, let us have, you know, what we have found. And that happens sometimes. And that's, you know, that's just part of our mantra. You know, we always say, it's found on your property. I'm willing to give it to you. It was the joy of finding it. If we get to keep it, it's bonus for us.
I love that. And so I want to talk about the fact that you recently made a few posts on Facebook asking homeowners if you can metal detect their property. I'm wondering why you would metal detect on a private property instead of sticking to public places like Milwaukee's beaches.
The beaches have been hit hard by other detectorists. During the months of October through April, nobody's on the beach. Nobody's losing their stuff on the beach. Then through from May till September, those beaches are populated and people might lose their rings or their bracelets or their change. And then there are a lot of people who, a lot of detectorists who go there after those weekends, and they can be kind of territorial sometimes, you know, saying, oh, this is my beach, you know, why are you here? I don't tend to go to beaches very often in Milwaukee. I like to go to private properties, you know, places that other people haven't been to. You always ask for permission. There is never a time when I just go randomly on somebody's yard. That would be trespassing. That's illegal. That breaks the code of a detectorist. So that's why I put out those letters, posts on Facebook looking for those permissions.
And do rules around metal detecting vary across the places that you visit?
Yes. There are some communities where they don't want detectorists in their parks. Milwaukee, sometimes they've been cracked down, the detectorists have been cracked down on saying, you know, you can't dig here. And that's basically because some detectorists aren't very polite. They don't refill their holes. They leave damage in the parks. You know, we try to refill and flatten down the ground as much as possible so that nobody knows we're there. Different counties have different regulations in their parks where you have to have a permit. Sometimes the permit is just free, where they just want to know that you know the rules. Some counties say, no, we don't want you there at all.
Are there rules of who gets what when it comes to finding things on public and private land?
Public land is a free-for-all, basically. I mean, you find it, it's yours, unless it's got some marking on it that you can return it to somebody. Class rings, sometimes people can trace back to other people. There is a small group of detectorists who are called ring finders. So somebody will put a post out and say, I lost my ring so-and-so here and here. And those guys or gals will go out and, you know, try to find it for them. Private land, always try to show what we find to the homeowners. Like this morning, I was out at a property in Wauwatosa, and it was a more modern property, mid-50s house. Didn't find a lot, found like 27 cents in change. There was a very small running medal, like from a high school, that I found. And I left with that homeowner. He said, my daughter will be overjoyed to see what you found in the yard. So that stayed with that homeowner. It didn't belong to him, you know, personally, but it's part of their land. You know, that house has been around for 75 years. Who knows who that belonged to?
That's so neat, though.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
So in general, I mean, you're kind of speaking to it, other than being basically untapped territory. Is there something special about metal detecting the yards of homes in Milwaukee?
I love the old homes. Milwaukee has great history. Wisconsin was established in 1848. Wisconsin has great ethnic history, especially Milwaukee. You know, so those old houses where, like, downtown Milwaukee just grew outward. You know, and you had those neighborhoods where people congregated in their ethnic groups, you know, the Irish, the German, the Poles. They had their stuff. They had their things. And sometimes we find those things when we go to these yards, and we can relate it to those houses or to those people. And that's the history that we enjoy really finding. Basically, we're modern-day time travelers. What was happening when this 1848 coin was made? Who held it? How did it get dropped? You know, you can think of all kinds of stories to make up about it, but you just really don't know. You just know that it's there and I found it.
You're the first metal detectorist I've ever met.
Okay.
Is there a metal detecting community in the Milwaukee area?
There is. In fact, we just had a meeting this past Tuesday. We meet once a month at a little restaurant in Cudahy. There are detecting clubs all through Wisconsin.
How many people would you say are in like the Milwaukee area metal detectorist club?
I would say there's probably 50 to 60. There has been a growing number of people showing up at this meeting, which is nice and surprising. It was typically a year ago we'd get maybe 8 guys.
So we've talked about how the thing that you most enjoy about metal detecting is discovering the history of the items you find. What are some of the most interesting items you found?
I found a medallion at a park in Milwaukee that dates back to the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. It was the Columbian World Expo Fair, which commemorated Columbus discovering America. And how did it end up in Milwaukee? It happened in 1893. So that's a memorable one for me. I really enjoyed that one. There's a book that goes along with that. My oldest coin that I've ever found is an 1842 Canadian penny minted in, it's called from the Bank of Montreal. It's called a bank token. It wasn't a, I don't know if they minted different coins from different areas in Canada, but that's my oldest coin find.
And where did you find that one?
That was at a farm in Kenosha.
Well, for people who might be interested in having you search their yards, where can they reach you?
They can send me an email at thebruce1959@gmail.com.
Bruce, thanks so much for speaking with me today. I'm super excited to get out there with you. And
I brought a detector that I'm going to have you try also.
You're going to have me try one?
Sure, why not?
Oh my God, I'm so excited. Okay, this changes the game. Okay, I'm so excited. Thanks. Well, I'm thank you for talking to me.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. This is just setting it up for the use of it.
So, would you be okay with recording me?
Yes.
Okay.
Because you want it out in front of you.
Okay.
You know, so like you're, can still be standing up straight, but you want to be able to extend your arm a bit.
Okay, that's it? Is this good?
Yes.
Okay.
Try to keep the coil low to the ground.
Okay, like that?
Yep. And swing, you have to, it should be swung all the time.
Am I going?
You're going fine.
Okay.
That sounds like a bottle top or a tin can.
Mm. Or a gold ring, no.
Oh.
We'll keep going.
Well, I think we should check that one out. Let me get the shovel.
Okay.
Okay, swing the detector back and forth. See how it ends when you pull back?
Yeah. So right there.
Yeah. I gotta dig a three-sided plug.
Digging the plug. I'll go this way.
Okay.
Alright.
And you try to visually see this. Do you visually see anything?
Rocks.
Yep, rocks and soil. Now you're gonna use that pinpointer and put it down in the hole, see if it.
So you're very close to it, whatever it might be. It's gonna be in the sidewall, like behind where you had that pinpointer. I'm going to give you the little shovel.
Okay. Oh, it's a nail.
Blasted nails.
So why was it so high?
It was a good signal. It's just a mix.
Just a mix.
Yep.
Oh. Bummer. I was ready for the ring.
I thought that was going to be a dime or a quarter.
Okay. Well, put this in your pouch.
Standard screw. Just fill it with your hand and stomp your foot on it. So it looks like it's even with the rest of the soil, and that's
Is that okay?
Yep.
Well, that was fun. Can I do one more?
Yep.
Okay.
Bruce Ratkowski is a metal detectorist in the Milwaukee area known as the Bruce. He spoke with Lake Effect's Excret Nunez this spring.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm WUWM's Tara Powell. In Milwaukee's Third Ward, it's kind of hard to miss the six-story mural of a human figure painted on the rear of a building at 320 East Buffalo Street. The painting shows a seated person wearing an apron, their hands crossed at their wrists and resting on their knees. A stack of legal pads lay next to them. In addition to its massive size, you've probably been drawn in by the fact that the figure does not have a head. The mural ends at their shoulders. One of our Bubbler Talk listeners wanted to know more.
I'm Heather Hathaway, and I've lived in Milwaukee for 30 years, and I teach at Marquette. I wonder what the headless mural is about in the Third Ward that you can see from the highway.
The mural is called The Unsung Hero. It was painted in 2019 by German artist Case McLean. He specializes in photorealistic murals, many of which center the subject's hands. A viewer could assume the unsung hero is some sort of laborer. They're wearing an apron, and their hands look like those of a person who works with their hands. This mural is an entry point to the history of the building it's painted on and the people who worked there.
So this is called the Dye House. And to the south of the Dye House, across Buffalo, it's called the Phoenix Building. And this was a hosiery business back in the day, in the early 1900s, and almost exclusively with women employees.
That's Jim Playstead, the executive director of the Historic Third Ward Association.
So the hosiery would be put together, sewed together, if you will, manufactured in the Phoenix Building. It would go literally underneath Buffalo. There's a tunnel there today that connects the two buildings. It's been closed off, but it's there. And then go into the dye house and they would dye them.
Playstead says the idea for a mural came from the building's former owners, Singerman Real Estate. The company was renovating the building at the time. Playstead says the company connected with Stacy Ung, the founder of Wallpapered City, a group that was the liaison for many Milwaukee murals. Ung found Case McLean. Playstead says artist McLean was inspired by the history of the buildings and the story of working-class women. McLean wanted a woman entrepreneur to use as a model for his painting.
So me and my staff, we put together seven women, gave them headshots, gave them a brief bio about their story and especially about their business in the Third Ward, and he picked Karen.
That would be Karen Bell, the chef and owner of Bavette La Boucherie, a butcher shop and cafe in the Third Ward.
They explained to me that they wanted to do a mural on the Dye Building and that they wanted to pay tribute to the history of the building and more specifically pay tribute to working women past and present.
Bell says she was honored to be part of the mural. In a 2019 Instagram post about the mural, McLean wrote, "To pay tribute to Milwaukee's female working class heroes from the past and to celebrate the present ones, I came up with this sketch of an anonymous representative." Bell, who modeled for the mural, says she was just that, the model, a representation of working women.
That's kind of what it meant to me. And I think if my head were on it, then it would be more about me when it shouldn't. That's really not the point at all.
The mural received a range of reactions when it was unveiled. On social media, some agreed that without a face, all women could see themselves as the unsung hero. But there were people who felt a headless woman perpetuated an idea that women are invisible and unseen for their work. At the end of the day, art is open to interpretation. There's always more than meets the eye.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from Educators Credit Union. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit WUWM.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
And Bubbler Talk wraps up Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, and X-Grit Nunez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Rob Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. Emily Files helps edit the show. We also heard from Mayan Silver, Jimmy Gutierrez, and Taryn Powell from the WUWM news team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon to learn why Wisconsin hosts an annual Lumberjack World Championship. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.